Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Saleri Report. We have a new guest today, Chuck Marone, who's a civil engineer from Minnesota. He's the founder and leader of Strong Towns. It's a not-for-profit based in Minnesota, and I'm a member. Our editor, our top picks, is an editor. It's a member, and we're regularly on the Strong Towns website and very interested in what they're doing, and we recommend it to you. And I wanted to get Chuck on because I think there's something very exciting, and for many of you, you may be able to plug into it. So, Chuck, welcome to the Saleri Report.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm really happy to be here, and thank you for being members. That means a lot.
Yeah, it's your membership is growing, and I expect it's going to grow a lot more. So tell us how you came to found Strong Towns. Give us the history, and then explain in more detail what you're doing now.
It was kind of an accident in the sense that I never set out to do this. If you would have asked me a decade ago, you know, you're going to be running a national nonprofit building a movement for change around the country, I would have said that's crazy. I worked as a civil engineer for many years and then went back to graduate school and got a planning degree. And in the course of doing that, wound up starting my own planning company. And I worked for cities all over Minnesota. We had 13 staff and 5 offices and we're doing all kinds of work, and I was kind of on the front edge of the whole growth thing we had going on in the early 2000s, the housing bubble, all that. I was involved in essentially building that and producing that, and in the middle of that vortex, it all seemed rather crazy to me. But, you know, like people running a business was good. And your incentives to question things when business are good are quite a bit less than when business goes bad. So I would, you know, talk about this stuff with cities and say, hey, I don't think this is going to work. But I didn't really have it figured out, and I didn't spend a lot of time on it. And then everything went horribly wrong, right? Between 2006 and 2008, before really it affected the broader economy, it affected us. And I wound up laying off almost all my staff, closing almost all the offices, had huge, you know, business debt, and all, it was just horrible. It was a nightmare. And amid all this, our advice was getting soundly rejected. I mean, I was telling cities, this is a disaster. Your budget is going to implode, and no one would listen to me. And so, you know, kind of at the depths of all this, right after the 2008 election, I sat down and started writing a blog. And I really, I say now, it was cheaper than therapy. I was just trying to sort my thoughts out and make sense of the world around me and actually kind of reach out to a broader group of people and say, are you seeing these same things or am I crazy? Because maybe I'm crazy. And everything took off and went, you know, we got a lot of readers. Our stuff got passed around a lot. I had 2 friends of mine that were helping me with it, and they encouraged me to start a nonprofit. We did that. We got a 501c3. I had a foundation contact me and actually say, we want to give you money to get this started. And they gave me 3 years of startup money, and I have not looked back since.
That's wonderful.
Today, it's kind of crazy because I never, you know, I met with this foundation, the Blandin Foundation up in Grand Rapids, Minnesota, and told them what I was doing. And they said, we want you to go share this message with everybody you can. And they gave me 3 years of startup money. And I've been doing that full time now since 2011, out trying to share this message with as many people. This year on our site, we will reach over 1 million different people. In the last 12 months, we've had 2.5 million different page views on our site. Those are insane numbers compared to where we were even 2 years ago. I will speak in front of over 10,000 different people in over 55, 58 events around the country. And yeah, like you said, our membership is growing and our movement is growing, and the number of people talking about how we build cities to be financially strong and resilient is growing. And right. it's a really important message. And once you hear it, you can't unhear it. And I think that's the most powerful part of it.
So let me just read your mission statement. The mission of Strong Towns is to support a model of development that allows America's cities, towns, and neighborhoods to become financially strong and resilient. And then there's a comment underneath. For the United States to be a prosperous country, it must have strong cities, towns, and neighborhoods. Enduring prosperity for our communities cannot be artificially created from the outside, but must be built from within incrementally over time. Now, you have two concepts that I wanted you to explain just a little bit before we leave the history, and that is, one is the community investment predicament, I'll call it, and the other is the Ponzi growth scheme. And yeah. one of the most instructive stories you told in several of your or in one of your videos was the story of applying for helping a one of your clients apply for a grant, realizing it was only going to make the matters worse.
It did. We made a problem way worse, and everybody got paid doing it. This was back in my engineering days, and this really, I won't say this prompted me to leave the engineering profession and go to graduate school, but it certainly was one of the things that I was kind of like an indicator, like this isn't working right. So I was working for a small town, and they had a leaky sewer pipe. The leaky sewer pipe was under a highway, and it was going to cost $300,000 to fix. I figured this out, and I actually felt really proud of myself because I had spent a number of nights, one, two in the morning, out pulling manhole covers and taking measurements and figuring this out. And I got the problem narrowed down to a block, a pipe. And if we could just fix this, we would solve this major problem they had with their sewage treatment ponds about to overflow and run sewage into a river. And it was a disaster. So I went to the council and I said, $300,000, we can fix this right now. Let's do it. And they said, well, that's great, Chuck, but our entire budget is around $100,000. Like we spent our last bit of savings paying you to do this study. We don't have any money. And so I was aware of these grant programs. The company I work for was very successful at getting grants. I went back to the office and I talked to the more senior engineers and they got me set up. And I went to all the grant agencies, and time again, I was told, Chuck, this feels like a maintenance project. You know, you've got a leaky pipe, you're just fixing it. This is maintenance. Maintenance is a local responsibility. We don't fund maintenance. I'm a smart guy. I could read the tea leaves. You know, I saw what was going on. I went back and I worked with the city to make it more than a maintenance project. We identified some of the poorer parts of the community that weren't served by the sewer system. We planned 2 miles of extension to hook them up. We doubled the size of their treatment facility. We put in a bunch of big pumps. And oh, by the way, we just happened to fix that leaky pipe too while we were there. Now it was a $2.6 million project. And I went back to the grant agencies and all of a sudden we met every checkbox. We had low-income people. We had a pending environmental catastrophe. We were creating good jobs. We had potential for growth. We met every criteria, and we got a huge amount of grants. The city wound up having to spend themselves only $130,000, and it was financed for them through the USDA over 40 years at sub-market interest rates. So they wound up, spending far less money than if they had gone out and fixed it themselves. Right. Understand what we did. We took a city that didn't have the money to fix 300 feet of leaky pipe. And the solution to that was to give them 2 more miles of pipe.
Right.
That bought them some time, but it ensures that someday that city will fail. Right. And I saw not only our company, but, this was what everybody in every city was doing all over the country, everywhere I looked. This is how we solved the problems because these were the only financial tools we had.
I love it. In one of your speeches, you talk about how Spain really lost its competitive edge as an empire because they put the capital in Madrid. And if you look at the cost of transporting goods to Madrid, it basically drained the empire. And what you were talking about was, I'll use my words, did the transportation infrastructure have a positive or negative return on investment? And what you said was, you know, the empire subsidized a negative return on investment transportation infrastructure for decades, and it basically put the empire down the ladder.
And it met a political objective. I mean, I think that's the thing that was astounding about that story to me is that you had this country that was surrounded by ocean, and they had become wealthy because they were seafaring. You know, they traveled around the globe and brought back all this gold, and you know, that was how they built their wealth. And the way they chose to spend it when they, you know, merged together as one country, as one empire in a sense, was they couldn't figure out where to put the capital, so they compromised and put it in the middle, in land. And right. Then, yeah, once they made that decision, essentially, you know, we invested now in this capital, they couldn't back down from it. They couldn't change. And even though the transportation system was bankrupting them, there were so many vested interests in, like, keeping that balance of power where it was, they couldn't change. And to me, it has a lot of parallels with where we're at now, because we've set up this system that is clearly bankrupting our cities, our neighborhoods, right. Our towns, and by extension, our families and businesses. Yet, right. You know, it's so hard to change. It is so hard to make it work differently.
Well, I think before it can change, people have to realize that there needs to be a change, that change is essential. So it's almost as though you need to see a picture of the future if you don't change, and versus a picture of what's possible if you do change. So in one of your videos, you're talking about how there's never enough money. If you have a system where you have a negative return on investment to taxpayers' investment, of course there's never enough money because the whole thing is draining everybody. But if you turn it to a positive, there's plenty of money. So
right.
This is not an issue of, you know, do we have enough money or not? It's a much deeper, more serious political issue. And it's, I think now with what's happening at the state and local level in terms of finances, it's one that's going to come to a head. And why I think Strong Towns offers really, you know, you have a way of breaking it down and unpacking the predicament into something that someone can go do in their or deal with in their neighborhood and their towns. So let me just ask you a little bit about your membership. How much of your membership are people on the Planning Commission or dealing with these kinds of issues?
I used to think that's who was reading our stuff. I had a sense, you know, because when I was writing, I was envisioning, I think we probably all do this, yeah, I was envisioning people like me reading this. So I'm thinking, right. You know, people who were involved in local government, who were maybe professionals. We call them apes here, the architects, planners, and engineers. I assume that a lot of them were that kind of people. We had right. Our first national gathering where we brought people who were interested in Strong Towns together. About 100 people showed up in Minneapolis to talk about this. Talk about this movement and what we were doing and what we could do differently and how, you know, just to talk about stuff. That blew my mind, because at that gathering, and since then we've kind of confirmed this in a number of different ways, we found out that our audience is about 10% that kind of people, and about 90% just what you could just in a broad classification say other, non-professionals, people who are not in a routine day-to-day thing dealing with these issues, but they love their cities, they love their places, they're frustrated by the current system, they want to see things changed. And for a large part, when you become a member, those are actually the people. You know, when people migrate from being members of our audience to members of our movement, and they right. You know, pay a little bit of money to do that, what they're really doing is they're kind of expressing their commitment to wanting things to change.
Right.
And we see them out doing amazing things, you know, out working in their cities, doing little pop-up projects and trying out little things. And some of them do run for council and some of them do serve on planning commissions, but a lot of them just spend their energies trying to make their block and their neighborhood better. And I'm, as someone who did not start from that place, you know, when I think of activism, You know, if you would have asked me 20 years ago, what's an activist? I would have said someone who's really annoying, who shows up at the meetings where I'm trying to make a presentation and gets in my face. You know, I did not come to this to be an activist, but I have learned so much from people and I am so inspired by them because, you know, our members are out doing fantastic, like world-changing kind of things. And I love the opportunity to highlight the stuff they do. If they have
the access to the kind of resources you're providing at Strong Towns, then when they show up at the Planning Commission, they can be much more effective for everybody.
That's the thing that, you know, I get up every morning, and that's the thing that, like, is this validation for my whole existence. I go back to the time when I'm banging my head against the wall, trying to explain things to city council members and getting laughed out of the room and sometimes fired, actually. Like, we don't want to hear this stuff from you. Go away. And, you know, to their credit, I maybe wasn't explaining it as certainly not as well as we do today. I maybe didn't understand it as well as I do today. If I can put things together that help the version of me out there to make this case in a better way, to explain it to people, to talk about it, I have given them a tool that isn't out there now. And the act of doing that has brought about so much change and good that I'm astounded. I never thought it could be that powerful. And yeah,
well, let me bring up a couple specifics of some of the materials you've provided that I think are unbelievably powerful. You did a long article on how the infrastructure of, I think it was Lafayette, Louisiana, basically, in my words, has a negative return on investment. And there was a really serious built-in economic problem with how they'd organize your infrastructure. Maybe if you could just tell us a little bit about that article.
I was invited along with a good friend of mine named Joe Minicozzi to go to Lafayette and work with them to answer this question about why they didn't have any money. And like most cities, they were getting pressured to build a bunch of stuff, yet they had this huge, huge backlog of maintenance. And you know, the politicians there, I give them a lot of credit. They push back on the chamber. They push back on, you know, the big businesses, all the people that wanted these, you know, new highways put in and new roads put in. And they said, like, look, how can we do this? We don't have money to fix what we have. This is irresponsible. And they asked us to come and explain this. And we did a big study. I mean, we dug into the finances of the city, what it costs to run this place, and how much money they're getting from all the different sources that they had, from utility fees and taxes and everything. Where's the money coming from and where is it being spent? And when you say they have a negative return on investment, that's actually being generous. They are a financial nightmare. That they have double the amount of public investment in the ground, sewer, water, storm sewer, road, sidewalk, curb, drainage system. They have $2 of that for every $1 of private investment.
Right.
There is no way that little bit of private investment can support that much public obligation. When we ran the numbers, the typical house in Lafayette pays $1,500 a year in taxes to the city. In order for them to meet every promise they've made just for infrastructure, just doesn't count pensions and all those other things we hear about, just infrastructure, the typical family would have to go from $1,500 a year to $9,200. One out of every $5 that family makes would need to go to the city to maintain roads and streets and pipes. That will never happen.
Right.
And you look at a place like Detroit and you can see a city that, you know, we all have an explanation for. I travel around the country, and when I ask people to explain Detroit, if you're in a place with people on the right of the political spectrum, they'll explain it one way. If you're on the left of the political spectrum, they'll explain it the other way. everybody has a comforting narrative to explain Detroit, and it always concludes with, we're not Detroit. And I look at Detroit, and I just see a place that got started with this whole approach 20 years ahead of everybody else.
Right.
They were the first city to run the highways through the middle of town, to rip down buildings for parking lots, to expand outward, annexing property and running pipe and running new roads and building frontage roads and strip malls. And they were the first ones to do this. And after World War II, we all copied them. Detroit's just 20 years ahead of everybody else. And right. When we look at Lafayette, there's no way they're going to fix all this stuff. So at some point in the near future, Lafayette and cities all over the country are going to deal with the fact that the way we build is, as you said, a negative returning investment. We often say it's financially not productive. It doesn't generate enough wealth to actually take care of everything. And when right. you do that, pouring more money on it, saying like, you know, oh, we don't have enough money to maintain our roads, let's go to the state and get more money. Let's go to the bond market and borrow more money.
It makes it worse.
It makes it worse. It makes it like exponentially worse. We actually have to change the approach. And then, yeah, it's going to take more money. I mean, a transition is going to take some money, but we can't just continue to keep doing what we're doing. It's bankrupting us.
So in the 90s, I spent a great deal of time building software tools that would allow you to look at government investment by place. We were loading in all the federal databases, but then we wanted to add state and local. It was called Community Wizard. And part of it was mapping out the negative returns, what they looked like, why they were happening, and then how you would convert them to positive return on investment. And of course, we walked right into the political buzzsaw of, and I'm going to tell you a story to give you an example. One of the things we discovered was in most areas, particularly urban areas, you would find the Department of Housing and Urban Development building new public housing for a cost at that time of $250,000 per unit, when $50,000 would literally buy out of the foreclosure property, single-family properties, and you could literally, for $50,000, you could buy and rehab a single-family property in the same 4 to 10-block area. So I, with the mapping that we were doing, I took this to this was then in the Clinton administration, to the assistant of the person running the public housing construction program, and I said, look, in New Orleans, in Chicago, in all these places, you could get 5 homes for the price of one. And she turned bright red and said, but how would we generate fees for our friends?
Right.
And yeah. many is the neighborhood where the thing that would most grow economic development is intellectual capital, but they're building another museum because the real estate is what generates fees. And if you look at a lot of the infrastructure you've been dealing with or what happened in Lafayette, you know, you've got this problem of fees for your friends, not only on the real estate and the construction, but on the bond deals. And so you have a political engine that, and of course, if you look at all the capital, the campaign contributions, it's generated from fees for our friends, but there's no proper planning process and disclosure around return on investment to the taxpayers. And I think the patterns of fees for our friends has gone way beyond what even the politicians doing it think makes any sense, which is why the politicians you were referring to that brought you in are very courageous to do this, because this machine is about to hit a wall all across the country. And of course, the question is, how do we convert it? How do we change?
I think that's it's a powerful story that you shared. And I look at it, and I there's this narrative we have in this country today, and it really is about the role of government. And I feel like it's the wrong narrative, right? Because we could clearly see that people who are cynical of government have every reason to be. I mean, the story you shared, I have seen in places myself. And I've seen where, you know, HUD is coming in building things that don't fit in with the neighborhood across the street from homes in foreclosure. Or, you know, or homes that are abandoned. And it's like, what is going on? When I did the little project where we got the grants, I got a bonus from my firm. My firm made a ton of money. They started calling me the rainmaker. The people that did the bonding got money. The guy that wrote the grant got money. Everybody in the system got paid. Who took it in the end? Who came out on the back? This poor city full of poor people living on the margins, barely able to maintain what they have, they're the ones in the end that pay for this. And they pay for it not in cash. I mean, they're going broke. I mean, we gave them something they can't afford. They're paying with it with cash too. But they're paying with it, like their hopes and dreams are being just stolen from them. Right. And that's what made me just tragic. Like that's what like made me angry. So this idea of, you know, should government do this or not? Should government be? I feel like our conversation needs to evolve to be, at what level is this best done? You know, at what level of government should we be talking about these things? And I've come to like the cynical conclusion maybe, and it makes it very difficult that I feel like in Washington, D.C., we're not going to get an answer to these problems. And at the local level, we have an opportunity to do so many helpful, productive things. Yes. But so many of our cities are looking to the state capitol and looking to Washington, D.C. for the answer, when the answer is literally sitting right in front of them if they just like turned around and looked at their own neighborhoods instead of this food chain of money. And
well, I have
that.
I have
that makes me feel very libertarian.
You.
Yeah.
That, you know, for 30 years, the interest rates have been coming down and there's been a long-term bull market in bonds. And that's now turning.
Yeah.
So
the
good news is the spigot is slowing down and is going to stop.
Well, and, you know, it's kind of one of those cascading things, too, because you see places like Illinois now, you know, a step above junk and their bond rating. And you can just look over to the EU and what happened when people started to realize that, okay, we realize Greece can't pay this back, but now they're actually not going to pay it back. And, you know, you saw bond rates spike up very quickly across the board, and not just for Greece, but all of a sudden for Ireland and for, you know, Portugal and Spain and Italy. I think that the untold story, or the story that is yet to work itself out with places like Illinois, is what impact is this going to have on New Jersey and California and some of these other kind of marginal, highly indebted places? And then, you know, you take a state like Minnesota, which is kind of in the middle of the pack in terms of pensions and debt and all that. Are we going to be able to handle interest rates that are, you know, even 2, 3, 4, 5% higher? I don't see how we do that. So I'm with you. I feel like as soon as this, if you're in the bond market right now, how do you justify that? I mean, do you think that yields will get better? Like go down? There's only one direction for things to go, right?
Well, I think interest rates are likely to go up a little bit, but I'm not a believer that they're going to go up a lot. And part of it is if you look at the global governmental, the whole sovereign bond market globally, it can't afford for them to go. And to a certain extent, they have the clout and ability to keep it down, particularly with demographics. So I don't expect it to reverse and head back up. But I do, you know, I think we're headed higher, but it's going to be 100, 200 basis points max. Now,
to me, that's the fascinating thing, though. For me, that's the fascinating thing is that you literally have a system that at this point is so fragile that it could not handle higher interest rates. And so the fact that people can actually push down rates artificially, you know, the unintended consequences of that are enormous. And that's where I look and I see this federal system that has all these weird incentives that are completely misaligned with the incentives of cities. And, you know, it's like one of these two is going to break. And it might just be, you know, they're codependent. So when one breaks, the other one will break. But one of them will
have to break. Well, I wouldn't say they're going to break. I think they're breaking right now. They're breaking as we speak. That's why we're talking.
Right, right.
Right. Absolutely. I think they've been breaking down for a long time. It just, you know, it takes a long time for an empire to die. So there's one DVD I love in I think it was 98, the PBS ran it. It's called New York, New York. And it's a 7 DVD series. It's very long. But in the third or fourth, they tell the story of the war between Bob Moses and Jane Jacobs' vision of cities and cities' economy. And it's really marvelous because you have Moses coming through sort of destroying local economies in poor neighborhoods by putting in these big, huge infrastructure projects and basically causing the city to go into a recession. I mean, basically killing the economy. And Jacobs coming back totally. And making another argument that I love that I see on the Strongtown website, which is the poor neighborhoods are profitable and the rich are draining the city.
It is so profound. And I think this is one of those liberating insights that once you grasp it, it changes your view of everything.
Uh-huh.
When you look at Robert Moses actually it checks off all the boxes that you know, the progressive urban people who want, you know, the big spending thing out of Washington D.C. to come in and transform their city. That's Robert Moses. And you know, it might not be highways through the middle of the city today. It might be condo units and you know, streetcars and whatever it is. But it's the idea that these big kind of top-down transformative things would then trickle down and have all these effects at the neighborhood level. And what Jane Jacobs like so brilliantly captured was the idea that the neighborhood level is where it's at. It's these small investments all coming together and interacting with each other and building on each other and having this kind of virtuous feedback that helps them, you know, incrementally grow across this broad area that creates all the wealth. And when we step back today in 2017 and we look at cities, what we see is that the neighborhoods that we would generally classify as poor or disadvantaged or underperforming, those places are, when we just do the math, when we run the numbers, producing more tax revenue per acre than the places that we would label as successful or new or doing well. And we see this in city after city after city. Your poorest underperforming neighborhoods are actually subsidizing everything else.
Right.
When we go to those neighborhoods and we say, okay, this neighborhood's already killing it financially, how do we make it better? The last thing they need is some massive intervention. What they need are small little projects. Let's make this place work for the people who are here. Let's tame this street so people can cross it. Let's put some street trees in. Let's patch up this sidewalk. Let's do the little, like, you know, block and tackle, meat and potatoes kind of basic maintenance stuff to make this place work because it's already doing awesome. I feel like if we actually, and this is going to sound really cynical, and I don't mean this on an individual basis, I kind of mean it on a collective basis.
Right.
If we really cared about the plight of poor, impoverished people and communities, we would transform our approach to be very fine-grained, bottom-up, neighborhood-led. You know, abandon this whole idea that there's some centralized big program we can do that will fix this. If you just go out and observe where people in these neighborhoods struggle and then try in an incremental way to address that, you're going to be making the highest returning investments you can make, and they're going to cost you nickels and dimes.
Right.
And that's the Strongtown's, you know, approach in a nutshell right there. Let's go make small investments.
Have you done anything with participatory budgeting?
I have seen some participatory budgeting stuff. I've never done any of that myself.
Right.
I find it fascinating, but I'll tell you what my hang up with it is. And this is not a deal killer. I think we could make it even better. But I think participatory budgeting, anytime you do something at the local government level where you're asking people to come in and participate, you tend to get a certain spectrum of people. And right. It's not necessarily the people that you need to have there.
Right.
I think at local government, we've become really good at setting up, and this is really a descendant of the 1970s environmental movement, which incorporated some social justice aspects. And the idea was there, if we shouldn't be doing things without public input and public hearings. Engineers, planners, economic development people, cities have become really good at doing a public process that is superficial and comfortable for them, but doesn't really get at what people need. And I feel like participatory budgeting sits on the margins of that. What we have advocated for is that if you really want to do public engagement, you don't go ask people what they want. You go out and observe where people are struggling, and right. You make small changes to adapt to that, to see if it helps their struggle. And if it does, you then improve on it and make it better. If you don't, right. Then you try something else.
Right.
I think if you look at Steve Jobs, who said, if you would ask people what they wanted in the 80s, they would have said, we want a better Walkman.
Right.
And I think that is in government, we're kind of stuck with that. You go ask people what they want, and well, we want, a big factory right. to come in and create jobs. We want a big project to employ people. In places, and I'll point to Memphis, Tennessee as a great example of this. When you go out and just watch, observe humbly, as a city professional, get out behind your desk, go out and humbly observe where people are struggling day to day to use your city, and then just try to respond to that and fix it. You're doing like the Lord's work. You're printing money for your city financially, because you're making really high returning investments that don't cost very much, and you're improving people's lives at the same time. That's where we're at in 2017.
Right. Now, one of the things that's coming upon us, we're in the process of watching enormous change in the economy coming from technology. So about 5 years ago, as I was driving around, I travel a lot by car in the United States. What I was seeing was as the traffic at the malls was slowing down, you had big warehouse installations coming up all over the country, 5 to 10 miles further out. So you definitely have changes in retail that are happening. And we know that driverless cars and trucks are coming. Now, when is a whole nother issue. But all of these things basically indicate that our infrastructure needs could change dramatically, yet are people really planning for them, and do we know how to plan for them?
I think it's bizarre that anybody alive today in a position of authority could do anything like a 30 or 40 year projection. And we do those, whenever we do a big infrastructure project, we do those all the time.
Right.
We'll do 50, 60 year projections. Here's what the traffic is going to be in 40 years. Yeah, we're in 2017. Go right. back to, 1987. And
right.
Show me the person who could have projected where we're at today. And that level of change is just accelerating. So I look at technology in two ways, because there's no question that technology is having an impact on who we are, how we live, and it's shaping our very lives every day. But I think that it's important to grasp that the problems that our cities face are not going to be solved with technology.
Right.
In fact, the Lafayette problem, where you have $2 of public investment to maintain off of $1 of tax base, that there's no technology that will solve that. That is a right. math problem that's going to work itself out in really, really destructive, kind of painful ways.
Right.
I feel like technology is bringing us to the point where, and I'll throw a literary movie reference at you, from the Hunger Games. We seem to be evolving towards a Pan Am kind of situation where you have some people who are going to be living at a certain level of technology and lifestyle that is very, very high, and kind of be surrounded by a lot of people who are, you know, maybe experiencing a tiny bit of that in a way, but not living the full set of, you know, automatic cars and, you know, fancy devices and wholly connected. And, you know, you can get into realms of healthcare and everything else. I feel like we are setting up a situation where this divide between the rich and the poor that we have so much angst over today, technology is, in a sense, an accelerator of that. And our development pattern is kind of locking that into place. And so I'm where a lot of people get excited about technology.
I agree with you that that's happening. But if you look at the, you know, so I spent a lot of time simulating what would happen if we turned return on investment to positive for the taxpayers. So if you just took, I was just looking at the federal budget, and state and local would be profound. But if you just took federal investment to taxpayers and turned it to positive, the wealth creation was so enormous that literally I had the smartest guy working for me go off and simulate it, and he kept coming back. And I kept saying, Henry, that's wrong. It can't possibly be that big. Right. And when you understand how negative the existing return on investment is, you know, all I can tell you is that if the day should come that we turn it positive and all government investment is subject to some, you know, the kind of standard that private capital is subject to, oh my God.
I could not
agree. The wealth creation is mind-boggling, and I'm not talking about new technology. I'm just talking about common sense.
Let me flip that around in a way, because I had this experience when I was running the numbers myself in the you know, mid-2000s, and started doing return on investment calculations on projects I was working on, and ones that I knew as an engineer, like, this is a great project. This is really going to work out great for the city. This is going to be wonderful. And I would run the return on investment analysis with real math, like real numbers, not equating time saved and congestion to dollars. This was like dollars in, dollars out. And I found that, like, the best projects were catastrophically negative return on investment. Like, they would return 10, 15 cents on a dollar.
Right.
And I looked at this and I said, my first reaction was, I have done something wrong. I am calculating this incorrectly, because there's no way this is so negative. But then I started to do more and more and more. And it just, the evidence became overwhelming to me that this stuff is a disaster. Like, it just sucks so much wealth.
Right.
I think that if we just stopped building stuff today, like if we just stopped building new stuff, the return on investment of stopping would be enormous.
Right.
I mean, it would be like, it's almost like if you quit shooting yourself in the head over and over and over and over, you're going to be better off. So if we just stopped, we would be in a better position. Now, if you could actually take it and do something positive, oh my gosh. Yeah, you're talking about, I can't even imagine that world, how successful that could be. Yeah.
Well, I want, Chuck, to get you back on the Salier Report to just talk about what would be possible if we did.
That would be fun, because
I imagined my estimate. So I come at this from the other side of the balance sheet. I'm an investment banker. I do investments. My whole thing is money. So I come at it completely from an opposite end. But what I will tell you, all of my estimations show that if we could turn this around, the wealth creation, and I don't just mean the financial wealth creation, I mean the human and intellectual capital wealth creation, is mind-boggling. So I continue to be an optimist just because I've seen the numbers. And I think most people, most good-hearted people struggling to make things work, underestimate the incredible harm this whole machinery has done you know, across the board, whether it's to people, to environment, to, you know, this is a killing machine. And and I think if you turn it around, the, you know, the sort of impact ecosystem wide is just absolutely wonderful. Well, let me, we're coming up in the hour, so let me just take, let's turn to the Strongtown network. And I would like our subscribers all want to do more local. They all want to do more local. So I just think every Salary Report subscriber needs to come to Strongtowns and become a member. So what I'd love you to do is just briefly walk through your website, the blog, the podcasts, the events. Yeah. Tell us what's there and tell us what someone coming in and looking, well, should I become a Strongtowns member? Tell them what they can get if they do.
Well, I think it's for us, the main thing is become part of our audience. If you feel compelled to be a member once you're part of our audience, that's wonderful. But what we are trying to do more than anything else is grow our audience and share our message. And so this whole thing started as a blog. We have transferred now to a full media site. And so we are a media organization sharing a message. If you come to our site, you will get 3-4 articles a day, podcasts, videos, of talking about these things in different ways. And we have a very ideologically diverse audience. People talk a lot about diversity, and I think we capture this very unique part of America now, where we have people who are very left of center, very right of center. We have a very interesting ideological conversation going on. So you're going to see articles on making your streets more walkable and how to do that. You're going to see articles on the Federal Reserve and the policies of the state and federal government. You're going to see things on transportation and housing. And we're trying to grow a conversation about how we make our cities financially stronger and better off. And that's a multifaceted thing. We've created a Slack channel. We have almost 1,000 people now who are chatting on Slack, and we've set up regional conversations. So there's people hyper-local talking about this stuff. There's people talking about it on a national level. There's places to go to figure this stuff out and talk about how this would work in your place. And meet other people, and you know, we have people who meet on Slack and then go off and do things together. It's been incredible. We have almost 2,000 members, and a bunch of them participate in our site. So they sometimes have their own blogs, and we'll run their stuff when it's good and share the things that they're working on and they're doing. And if you become a member, we do some member things. I mean, every now and then we do like webinars and stuff where we let, you know, members can ask questions and be part of it kind of live. But we really don't have like member exclusive stuff, because our whole thing is trying to share this message with as many people as we can. Our members are really, yeah.
I think it's a great, Strongtowns is a great, website to understand both what's happening, and this is the same dynamics are happening in every municipality, every town, every county. So
isn't that crazy?
It's great to help. Well, no, because if you look at the financial model is basically pumping out capital at a zero or a negative cost of capital, and that's going to lead to wildly, and there's no calculation or internal financial control to put it through the proper investment hurdles, etc. And so, of course, you're going to get a mess. I mean,
everybody thinks their city. Yeah. Everybody thinks their city is unique. And I have to break it to everybody, like, you're not.
You're not.
The whole lesson of 2008, the people who put together the collateralized debt obligations with the mortgage-backed securities, they assumed that California was uncorrelated with Florida, was uncorrelated with Minnesota, and no, they're perfectly correlated. They're all the same.
So not for discussion today, but I was Assistant Secretary of Housing in the first Bush administration. I tried to stop the fraud, so then I had to leave, and I got hired back as lead financial advisor during the Clinton administration, and again, I tried to stop the housing bubble. And to start the housing bubble, because the housing bubble was engineered by the Treasury and the central bank top down. You know, yes, yeah. The New York Fed member banks did it, but, you know, it was very much engineered from government because the housing system is very socialized. Anyway, there was a group of us that tried to stop the housing bubble. We said, no, America needs to, you know, shift taxpayer investment to positive return, and we need to pay down our debt, and we need to build new skills, otherwise the middle class is going to get wiped out, et cetera, et cetera. We need to rebuild places in a way that's going to make money for the pension funds so they can meet their targets, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, that vision was rejected, and they said, no, let's bubble the economy and suck as much capital out and move it abroad. So we got run over. Right. And yeah, the reality is, I used to drive around and watch. I would literally drive through a city and see these huge housing developments going up with 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 square feet in the suburbs, knowing full well that there was no way that either the homeowner or the municipality could support this infrastructure over the next 20 years on an economic basis. You know, I just watched it all being built in a way that would put everybody in the hole. I used to cry driving down the highway.
I had about 6 months where I said the only thing I can do is build like a bunker in my backyard and stock it full of food, because this whole thing, it was so depressing. And I moved on from that. Like I see hope now, right, where I didn't at first. But yeah, I went to one city once. I mean, this is crazy. I went to one city and I showed them while they were doing a plat to do a new development. So putting in like 25 new lots, I actually did an analysis and I showed them, you have, at the current rate we're building homes, which is the peak, we've never built as many homes in 1 year as we did last year. If that rate continues every year, it is going to take you 125 years to develop all of the lots that you have today with roads and sewer and water and everything ready to be built on. It's going to take 125 years.
Right.
That means that your property is worth zero. Like, you should never plat another lot. This market doesn't make any sense. And you know what their response was? Hey, we don't pay you to think like that. We want you to just process. The developers here doing it. Yeah, you're being negative. The market will work that stuff out. You're not smarter than the market. Just, you know, do your job. And
the market was levitating on financial fraud, and they needed to put out more fraudulent paper.
Well, that developer actually went bankrupt too, and I have to admit, like, guiltily, like, I'll go to confession over this. You know, I took some glee in that guy's demise because he was a jerk.
Now, you also Strongtowns has events around the country. Yeah.
Yes. Just
give us a minute on the events that you're doing.
Well, I get invited to speak a lot of places, and we have a program called the Curbside Chat Program where we come to your community and share this message. I also get invited just to speak at a lot of different places where people are trying to change the conversation. And I feel very blessed to be able to do this. When you can sit down with a group of people for a couple hours and, you know, share information with them and then have a conversation, it leads to significant moving of the needle. And it's been, you know, I started doing this in the very early days here in central Minnesota. And then I got invited to go speak in North Dakota. And then I got invited to do a whole tour in California. And I got to say, I have learned so much. I've been in every state now, except for Hawaii and Alaska. Right. I have learned so much from seeing this country through Strongtown's eyes and being able to have these conversations all over. And that has allowed me to do this even more effectively. The curbside chat stuff and the events are the most powerful thing we do. And I'm headed to Indiana in a week and a half. I'm in a little bit of a travel lull right now, but as soon as September picks up, it's every week.
Now, have you, on your travels, have you hooked up with the Weston Price Foundation groups around the country?
No, I feel kind of ignorant. I've never even heard of the Weston Price.
Okay, so this is a name I want to give you. Weston Price Foundation, those are the foodies. And if you look at where the growth is going to come, you know, economically, it makes sense for far more food to be grown locally for a variety of reasons. When you look at the economics across the health, across the whole ecosystem, including healthcare. So improving local food is usually highly economic in a place, particularly if we change, we get out of the debt growth model and into more equity. And Weston Price has built networks, clubs of people working on this who are some of the most positive people. And my guess is the Strongtown Network and the Weston Price Network need to meet each other.
Yeah. I love talking to you. Seriously, like, you and I have never chatted before. I'm finding you absolutely fascinating because, yes, I go around and when people ask, like, where do we start? And local food is, you can already see it happening.
Right.
The economics of the empire, you know, the food system delivery from internationally, that's like the weakest link. And
right,
it's the easiest thing to replace locally. And you see it happening all over the place.
Well, if you look at the food system, a lot of the food system has been engineered to central control by federal subsidies and federal rules. And once those subsidies start to go away, the economics revert back to something much more local. So So I'm making a list of conversations I want to have with Chuck and Strongtown.
This would be fantastic. I was out in Wyoming and I met these guys who were doing farm to table out there. And the interesting thing, and this is why I feel lucky to be able to travel as much as I do, you find these places that are on the margins, right? So if you're in Wyoming and you're a farmer, all your stuff gets shipped out through Duluth. And so you get the price of you know, beets in Duluth minus the transportation cost. So you're getting the lowest cost in the country for your ag product.
Right.
Conversely, when finished product gets shipped back to you, you pay the price in Duluth plus the transportation costs. And so you pay the highest price in the country. So the guy was showing me, like, a box of Cheerios costs way more here, and we get way less for the grain that goes into it. So we just make Cheerios here locally. You know, we don't call them Cheerios because that's a brand name. We make our own, like, grain cereal. And it's easy to do, and it costs less, and it tastes better. And you look at that at the margins, and you see how they can do it there. And then you realize that, oh, my gosh, this same thing applies here, but, like, there's no incentive to do it because we're just inundated with, you know, big grocery stores and everything else. Like, who's gonna do this? But people are starting to, and it's fascinating.
Right. There's tremendous, many, many conversations I want to have with you.
Likewise.
Tell us again, your URL and how you come in and learn more and sign up.
You can find us at strongtowns.org. And if you're on Facebook or Twitter, we post a lot of stuff there and are having very active conversations. Just look up Strong Towns. And if you're interested in Slack, strongtowns.slack.com, we've got one of the most active conversations anywhere today going on there, and we welcome you to be part of that as well. Thank you so much.
Let's just say I'm coming into Strong Towns, and I want to find one thing I can do in my local area. Where would you send me first? Where do I find out great ideas for what I might do in my place?
Well, I think that there's if you were brand new, I would say go to our newcomers page, which actually, if you scroll down above the fold, it's right. There's a big button that says new to Strong Towns, start here. And we try to make that introduction as easy as we can for you. But if you want to go right to, like, what do I do? Go to strongtowns.org and then /success. And what you're going to get is a long, long list of success stories of people who, you know, motivated by Strong Towns conversations, have gone off in their communities and done things. And some of them are big. Some of them are really, really small. There's a bunch of things on there, and you can go and be inspired by that and get ideas for what you can do in your place.
Okay, great. Well, Chuck, I can't thank you enough for what you're doing, and I can't thank you enough for joining us on the Salieri Report, and we want to get you back.
Thank you. Well, I feel like I've met a new good friend today. So, yeah, anytime I can find someone who, like you, who is, you know, grasped this as an intelligent, and I don't have to explain why the world is crazy. We can use that as a starting point.
Can I tell you one more story? Okay, so when I became Assistant Secretary of Housing, for the first 30 days, I found myself lobbied by real estate folks and mortgage bankers and all sorts of people in the construction industry. And I had this growing sense of free-floating anxiety. Something was terribly wrong. And finally, I realized they were all lobbying me to do whatever made their stock go up. But nobody really cared about the health of a place. And and I thought, well, this is way out of balance because we, you know, I'm being lobbied to make the Dow Jones Index go up, but nobody cares about the health and well-being of a place. And that's where, you know, the economy works bottom up. So I thought and thought and thought, and I came up with something called the Popsicle Index. Okay. The Popsicle Index is the percent of people in a neighborhood who believe a child can leave their home, go to the nearest place to buy a Popsicle, and come home alone safely. So I'll say it again. It's the percent of people in a neighborhood who believe a child can leave their home, go to the nearest place to buy a Popsicle, and come home alone safely. Now, what was interesting is, so I started to look at all the government money and went back and sort of looked at the HUD budget for over many decades. And one of the things I saw was that the Popsicle Index was falling steadily in most places, while the Dow Jones was rising up. There was sort of a perfect inverse correlation. And one of the things I realized was that if you look at the financial value of a community, both the real estate and the businesses, there was a remarkable relationship between the Popsicle Index and the value of the real estate and businesses. So if people feel safe, and of course the most vulnerable are the children, but if the children feel safe, then the adults feel safe. If people feel safe, then there's a lot of trust going around. If trust happens, then you know, people want to live there, particularly if there's good education, and you know, the economy starts to flow, and the next thing you know, you have a high Popsicle Index, and there's a correlation between the Popsicle Index and the value of the businesses and the real estate. So my theory in the 90s was, okay, let's go into a place, let's make an investment in a place and that has a low Popsicle Index, and let's get the Popsicle Index up and make a whole bunch of money. It's kind of the simple. Well, but that opportunity still remains to be done, because all the Popsicle Index is just a way of expressing the living equity in a place versus the financial. Now, we've watched interest rates come down in the long-term bull market in bonds. So government was pumping out bond money, but then the Dow Jones is going up, up, up. And one of the reasons you feel like there's no money is there's an inverse relationship between the Popsicle Index and the Dow Jones Index. But in fact, you could reorganize the financial system so you had a win-win relationship. Right. So that instead of having a win-lose relationship between the Popsicle Index and the Dow Jones Index, you had a win-win relationship. And in fact, if you create the conditions of that win-win, then suddenly, you know, all the Dow Jones players have a reason for your kind of planning standards to happen.
Right. If you gave the Popsicle Index to someone with a Jane Jacobs mindset, they would try to localize everything, make it fine-grained, give a lot of like complex feedback in a place, and start incrementally building something great. If you give the Popsicle Index to someone with a Robert Moses mentality, they'll go out and, you know, have a government program to put a Popsicle stand on every corner, right? You know, completely like, okay, we met the metric now. And
my favorite thing with the Popsicle Index is to say to people, I want you, you know, here's 100 points, as in 100%. I want you to define for me what is causing your Popsicle Index to go down. In fact, at one point we had a bunch of grade school kids and we were teaching them how to use video cameras so they could go around their neighborhood, make little films about what was causing their Popsicle Index to go down. And it's just what you said about finding out what's causing people problems and then just fixing those.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Isn't that, right. isn't the thing is we, it's too easy. I almost feel like it's too easy, right? Like if it was, I go and talk to cities and I talk to these professionals and they're smart people and they're tied up with all these grant programs and big projects and all the stuff they're trying to do. And you tell them, you know, go out and figure out where people are having trouble crossing the street and make that easier. And it's almost like it's beneath them, right? It's just too simple, Chuck. And I almost feel like we're our own, you know, if we could just get a little bit of professional humility, you know, we'd realize how powerful that stuff is.
Right. Right. Well, I don't know. I think you're making the popsicle index go up all over the country. So
I hope so.
So
well, thank you so much.
Keep it up. Thank you for a wonderful conversation. I look forward to talking again.
I do as well. Let's chat some more. You take care.
Bye.